It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a guest makes the case against the privatization of public lands in Wisconsin and around the country.
Now, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis announced that he'll leave his position in February. Mattis reportedly resigned after a clash with President Trump over the decision to withdraw troops from Syria and Afghanistan.
In his resignation letter, Mattis said that he was stepping down in part to allow the president to choose a Secretary of Defense whose views and opinions on U.S. military actions and international relationships were more aligned with those of President Trump. Our next guest is here to talk about what could happen next and what it all means for American security policy.
Stephen David is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University, where he specializes in international security issues. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Stephen, what was your reaction to the news that Jim Mattis was leaving his position in February?
Well, in some ways I was shocked but not surprised. Shocked because of the implications where this may lead us, but not surprised because it was clear that President Trump and Mattis have been at odds for a long time.
How would you characterize Mattis's tenure as Secretary of Defense overall?
And he did a solid job. He kept relationships with our alliances strong. He has improved the readiness and effectiveness of the military. I think most leaders saw him as a steadying force, as someone they could rely on and depend on in an otherwise very uncertain environment.
Now, Mattis's resignation comes right after President Trump announced that he would withdraw troops from Syria and Afghanistan. He overruled Mattis and other advisors who argued that U.S. troops should stay in these countries. So what was the president's rationale for pulling troops out of Syria and Afghanistan?
Well, the president made campaign promises. It's part of his America First vision that American troops should not, you know, fight and die in far-off conflicts, that we have to be concerned with America First. And it has a certain superficial appeal, but the problem, as we learned in 9/11, sometimes problems that develop in faraway places come back to bite us. And sometimes an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And this is especially true in Syria, where we've had about 2,000 troops there for a couple of years. In the past year, there have been no American casualties. And the troops have been a steadying force, advising our Kurdish allies, hammering away at ISIS, keeping Turkey and Iran and Russia at bay. For a small number of troops at small cost, they've been doing a tremendous job. And I think when President Trump told Mattis he was going to withdraw them, that was the final straw. It wasn't the only point of conflict, but it was the final straw, and Mattis felt, I can't do this anymore.
Stephen David is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University, where he specializes in international security issues. And we're talking about the resignation of Jim Mattis, who is the Secretary of Defense. Mattis wrote in his resignation letter, and I quote, "My views on treating allies with respect and also being clear-eyed about both malign actors and strategic competitors are strongly held and informed by over four decades of immersion in these issues," end quote. He's touting his experience, which is why the president nominated him in this position to begin with. So you alluded to it a little bit earlier, but outside of Syria and Afghanistan, what were the other issues between the president and Mattis?
Well, as Mattis's letter indicated, Mattis believes very strongly that American allies are important for American interests, whether they be in NATO, Japan, elsewhere. And treating them with respect is critical, something that, in Mattis's view, I believe, Trump did not do. Mattis is also concerned about America's enemies, especially Russia. President Trump has yet to say a negative word about President Putin. And Mattis, on the other hand, sees Russia as one of the primary threats to the United States. And serving a president who doesn't share this view became untenable.
Now, the Pentagon and others say that there could be massive consequences with withdrawing troops from Syria and Afghanistan. If that happens, what might we see?
Well, I think the Syrian case is more pointed, because I was with Afghanistan. We're leaving some troops there. And you can make a case in Afghanistan that, you know, we've been there, I don't know, 17 years, and it's not clear that we'll ever be able to produce a desirable outcome. Syria is different. Again, as I said before, the costs are not that great. We've had 2,000 troops there. They're steadying our Kurdish allies. They're going against ISIS. And, you know, President Trump's view that, well, ISIS is defeated, we don't have to worry about it anymore, I mean, that's hogwash. ISIS has 30 to 40,000 ideologically driven recruits on the ground. Just last month, they launched a major counteroffensive. They've been greatly diminished, but to say they've been defeated is silly. And Mattis knows that. The Pentagon knows that. In fact, President Trump's national security advisor and national security team also know that and have repeatedly said that American troops are vital to the Syrian mission. So when President Trump on his own simply says, okay, they're all coming home, that's hard to accept.
So what does this do to the United States' reputation abroad?
Well, America's reputation abroad has already plummeted. If you look at surveys of leaders, of people, those who say they can rely on the United States, have trust in America, has gone way, way down. Probably the lowest point it's been maybe since the end of World War II, even worse than in Vietnam. This will make a very bad situation even worse. But I've got to say, I worry about other things as well. The president has a good deal more discretion in the international foreign policy realm than he does in domestic politics, where he's constrained by courts and Congress and other institutions. As president, he's commander-in-chief, and to a great degree, he can do pretty much what he wants, and I find that frightening. The president, for example, on his own, can order a nuclear attack. Now, I'm not suggesting that President Trump's about to order a nuclear attack, but having a defense secretary who is reliable and as a stabilizing force is an added constraint against the president doing something reckless and impetuous. And now we've lost that, and we don't know who's going to take his place. And frankly, it's hard to think of people of high character and ability who want to be in that position.
And with that said, Mattis wrote in his resignation that the president has the right to appoint a defense secretary whose views are more aligned with their own. So what changes might we see then with a new defense secretary?
Well, the hope was that people like Mattis and Tillerson, as Secretary of State, Kelly, Chief of Staff, would restrain some of the more reckless proclivities of the president. But they're all gone. So the question is, who's going to constrain Trump? Now, maybe in terms of his base, they want President Trump to be Trump. And they might be happy with someone who, instead of saying, no, don't do that, say, you know, attaboy, that's great, let's double down. But I think if you look throughout the international security community, including those on the Republican side, there's a great deal of fear and anxiety about what happens next. What happens when there isn't an adult in the room with the experience and gravitas to say, no, this is not what we should do, and here's why. So this is an extremely important appointment, whoever will replace Mattis. And I'm sure the world is watching very nervously as to who that's going to be.
Well, you talked about there's a lot of hand-wringing over the fact that Mattis was seen as one of the last adults in the room. But on the other side of the spectrum, there have been people who say they're glad that he's leaving. So what were some of the criticisms of Mattis?
I know of very few people who say they're glad that he's leaving. I'm not sure who you're referring to. I mean, there may be some individuals at the heart of President Trump's base who wanted an even more isolationist foreign policy. but I've yet to see someone in the national security community, including those in the Trump administration, who have welcomed his departure.
Well, to be continued, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Stephen David is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University, where he specializes in international security issues. He joined us today to talk about Defense Secretary Jim Mattis's resignation from his position.
In Wisconsin and across the nation, conflicts are playing out over public lands and who gets to own or manage them. While the issue of land ownership has been around for as long as we've had public lands, calls for privatization seem to be getting louder these days, and in some cases, moves are already being made in Congress.
President Trump opted last year to reduce the size of two national monuments in Utah by 2 million acres, making it the largest declassification of protected land in U.S. history. But our next guest says moves like this are misguided, and in a new book, he lays out the case for preserving, protecting, and supporting public lands.
Stephen Davis joins us now. He's a professor of political science and environmental studies at Edgewood College in Madison. His new book is In Defense of Public Lands, The Case Against Privatization and Transfer. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, are we seeing growing calls? We've always had some controversy, but growing calls in recent years for privatization or federal to state transfers of public lands.
Yeah, since 2010, when the kind of Tea Party movement started and the Republicans took over Congress, there has been what you might call a wave of legislation. Now, none of these bills have become law, but quite a few have actually passed the House of Representatives, making it, through the process pretty well. In Wisconsin, we've seen a 10,000-acre privatization ordered in the 2013 budget. And that was kind of privatization for privatization's sake. It was an order to the DNR. They had about 4 years to go find 10,000 acres. And they did actually a really good job in finding the least destructive collection of acreage they could round up. But we saw that completed last year. And you also saw the removal of the entire state park budget, the entire state park system from the general budget. So now the state parks have to do what a lot of observers think is ultimately impossible, which is totally to support themselves through revenue.
Now, before we get into your case for keeping public lands public, can you talk about the variety of things that we're talking about when we use a phrase like public lands? It can mean a lot of different things.
So there is about 600 million acres of federal public land, and we're largely, in the book, I'm largely talking about conservation land, so they're not like military bases or Indian reservations. So of that 600 million acres, there's four major categories. There's BLM ranch land, rangeland, I should say, and there's national forests run by the U.S. Forest Service. There's the national park system, which is probably the sort of public land most people are familiar with, but that's only about 12% or so of the federal land. And then there's wildlife refuges, which are about 89 million acres. Then there's about 200 million acres of public land in the 50 states having similar categories of land. And then there's somewhere between 10 and 25 million acres of local city parks, county land, county forests, which are a major thing in Wisconsin.
And you make the case for public lands in a few different ways. Biological or ecological is one, political and economic. Let's take each of them in turn. The ecological and biological benefits of having public lands. Talk about
that. Yeah, so the privatizers make this argument that sort of makes sense on paper, that they like to say nobody washes a rental car, meaning that if you don't own something yourself, you're not going to take care of it. You take care of what you own. And the idea being that because your livelihood depends on the productivity of a piece of land, you're going to take really good care of it. And public land no one really owns, therefore no one really takes care of because no one's accountable. The data shows that that's just not true with public land versus private land. If you look at various measures that really matter, which is, for example, biodiversity. So I looked at a bunch of different measures, how fragmented are forests, how much suitable habitat for what we call conservative species, species with really specific needs, actual discrete populations of imperiled species and endangered species. Acreage of imperiled landscapes, like here in Wisconsin, the oak savanna, or freshwater dunes in Michigan and on the Lake Michigan shore here in Wisconsin. Old growth forests. How much ecological restoration is going on? How much of the land is actually being actively restored? And in every one of those measures I looked at, public land outperforms private land. It's in better shape. It's being managed better on those outcomes related to biodiversity.
And when we talk about federally managed lands, the debate isn't just the federal government runs them or they're sold off into private hands. The other option people make the case for is state control, saying, hey, we're here. We can manage this. We know what's going on better than somebody out of Washington, the argument goes.
So if you look at state lands, there's actually two types. Of the 200 million acres of state land, about one quarter, 50 million acres, resembles the federal portfolio of land, you know, state parks, state forests, state wildlife refuges. The other 150 million acres, it's a little complex, but they're called trust lands, and those were kind of granted at statehood when each of the states, especially out west, became states. Wisconsin actually has a little bit of this as well. They were granted sections in a township, two or four sections of land within a 36 section township for use in the public schools. It was to raise money for public schools. So that land from the start was geared towards making money, and it wasn't technically public. Like, you don't go hunting there, you don't go hiking there. That's the model when they say to transfer land to the states. That's the model that's largely upheld. So if, for example, the national parks or national forests of Montana were to be transferred to the state, it would largely be in that resource production model in which the public would not be guaranteed access. It would not be managed necessarily for wildlife or biodiversity as the state trust lands are not.
Talking to Stephen Davis from Edgewood College. His new book is In Defense of Public Lands, The Case Against Privatization and Transfer. Now let's turn to the economic argument. The privatization argument, as you talk about in your book, is that a private owner is going to be able to make the best use out of land in a better way than public ownership. You try to take a wider look at the economic impact of public land.
So essentially, the privatizer's argument is very, very narrow, and they look at the operational cost. What does it cost to run, to manage public land, and sometimes to acquire it, if that is part of how the land came to be, especially east of the Mississippi. Governments often, local governments will often buy public land. And so what are its costs and what are the revenues that come out of that? Now, that's a curious way to look at it, because we don't apply that to any other government service, or not too many other government services. We don't say that about defense. We don't even say that about libraries. We think that there's something valuable and we provide for them. So I wanted to widen the lens and look at a lot more than just how much does it cost to run this and how much comes in directly through revenue, like selling timber or charging an entrance fee. And there's some traditional ways to look at that. Multiplier effects, how much does land, the presence of public land or a park bring to the regional or community, gateway communities around it. And studies show there's about a 2.08 to 2.39 percent multiplier effect, meaning for every dollar you spend, it spins off like another $2. And that's on par with most industries. Return on investment's another way to look at this. And every study done on public land, either acquisition or operations, show a 400 to 1100% return on investment. In other words, for every dollar you spend, you get $4 to $11 back. But the argument that's most interesting to me is one that environmental economists are making much more frequently these days, and that's this notion of ecosystem services. And that's all these spectacularly valuable things that nature, functioning ecosystems, public land provides us that no one ever accounts for. Things like pollination services, carbon sequestration, water retention, water quality. They're considered in the free market models as just free goods, but they are not. They're worth hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars by various accounts. And if you just think of the flooding that we had around Madison, and I promise you it would have been so much worse and so much more damage and expense if we were not ringed by public wetlands around all sides of our city. And those wetlands saved us probably tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars.
And in our last minute or so, the political case, you say there's value in effect to this land is our land when it comes to public lands.
It's the most absolutely democratic institution we have. Everyone owns it. Everyone could access it. And it's incredibly valuable thing that we all own together. And the main complaint of the critics is that it's a messy, conflictual thing to manage this. But that's the nature of democratic governance, and it's nothing to apologize for. They say, you know, it's too chaotic, and if we owned it privately, there'd be no more conflict. And I say that's too high of a price to pay, and democracy is conflict.
And briefly, do you see the pendulum swinging back in favor of public lands?
I really have. The advent of, you know, the Trump years have really shaken people's confidence that this land will be there in the future, and people have really rallied. And with the recent elections, I think, the pressure is the immediate pressure is off a little bit, and I see a movement growing and a lot of attention being paid now where it wasn't before. People just took it sort of for granted.
Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stephen Davis is a professor of political science and environmental studies at Edgewood College in Madison. His new book is In Defense of Public Lands, The Case Against Privatization and Transfer. It's Food Friday. This time of year, a lot of us are making New Year's resolutions, and that got us thinking about the things we want to get better at in the kitchen. From making sure we throw out less produce to taking on a whole new style of cuisine, there's a lot to practice and improve on.
And if you have a New Year's resolution for the kitchen, let us know about it at 800-642-1234. Is there a certain type of dish or food you want to master? Maybe there's a new piece of equipment you want to put to use. Are there techniques that you plan to practice in 2019? And if you've mastered a cooking skill that used to give you trouble, how do you do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Lori Skelton is a classical music host at WPR and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back.
It is great to be here, even though I sound a little croaky today.
Little hoarse, 'tis the season. Mm. Well, I think a lot of people are in my boat where we like to cook, but you know, you get into a comfort zone and maybe you don't want to try something new. Why do we get risk averse sometimes in the kitchen?
Unfortunately, like anything else, cooking does not come easily the first time out. If it does, please tell me what magic you're using, because you do need to practice. And unlike sitting down and spending time practicing an instrument, if you're going to practice in the kitchen, you know there's a cost involved. If you screw up a recipe, you're thinking, okay, I just spent how much money on all of these ingredients and it didn't work out. I think that's why a lot of people are hesitant to practice or practice something new. They've had one or two failures and think, you know, that's just not good for my budget to keep making these mistakes.
You know, speaking of messing up, messing up a recipe, I think, and also practice, I think one of the things that can make cooking those new dishes easier and less risky is measuring out ingredients beforehand and getting them arranged. Can you tell us why that's important?
It is helpful, first of all, because it says you've read your recipe. You know exactly, do I have all the ingredients. How many times have we been there? We're rushing around, we're throwing things together at the last minute. You get halfway through the recipe and you realize, oh, the whipped cream that I thought was still good has completely curdled. I can't use this. Now what am I going to do with that recipe?
Yeah.
So doing what the French call mise en place, put it in place. I started doing this seriously about 5 years ago, and this has really helped my cooking, getting everything measured in advance. You'd think, gee, isn't that going to take more time? Shouldn't I just be chopping and measuring as I go? I've discovered that it's one of the easiest ways to lose track of what you're doing. It's an easy way to burn something, to overcook something, because you're not paying attention to the actual final process of cooking. So it's what professional chefs do. They do all the chopping, they do all the measuring, they get everything set up before they start cooking. Then they know the butter is at the perfect temperature. They're not having to shove something in the microwave to soften it at the last minute. They've got the right kind of paprika that the recipe calls for. Then, once you have everything that you know you need, that's when you can start getting creative at your kitchen. If you've put in the recommended amount of mustard and then you taste it and go, you know, I really think this needs more for what I want it to taste like, then of course you can add at the last minute. But it helps so much. It helps keep your mind focused if you go ahead and do what they do on the cooking show. Have everything set out in those cute little bowls. It's not just to make it easier for the camera person. It's to actually make it easier for the cook.
That should be a good resolution for me this year, because I've been burned on that moldy applesauce when I was baking one time, or that recipe you're reading, and it's like, oh, it says to bake 40 minutes, and then you missed a bit, then put it back in and bake another half hour. Uh-oh. Hey, everybody, dinner's late tonight. Been there.
Yeah.
And, Lori, I understood you had a resolution for 2018 on some curries. Is that right?
Years ago, on a Food Friday show, I was interviewing the author of a book called 660 Curries. And over the years, I'd make one or two. And every time I'd make one, my boyfriend would say, you know, this is really different and it's really delicious. So about a year and a half ago, we decided, until we get sick of it, we're going to make a brand new curry a week.
Wow.
And with a couple of weeks where other things got in the way, we've held to that. And we've been having a ball. We've discovered my boyfriend has a certain flavor profile that he really gravitates to. There's a few things that I like a little bit differently in a curry. So now, here again, we're able to break away from the recipe because we took the time to practice. Yes, we had a few mistakes, but we had this system in place where we knew it's one curry a week and we're going to try something new. And we've learned so much about how we like to cook and how we like to eat, focusing on just one kind of cuisine.
You know, one of the things that I've admittedly taken for granted, but I know it's very important when it comes to the kitchen, is a sharp knife.
Oh,
But keeping the knife sharp in the right way is a skill. Is that something worth learning in the new year?
Absolutely. I asked on Facebook my friends, what do you want to do in the kitchen? And I had one woman say, I'd like to stop the bloodshed in the kitchen. she's got a big family, and she and her husband are busy, but she says they get rushing around the kitchen, and one meal in eight, somebody is reaching for a Band-Aid. And the first thing I thought of is, Kelly, when was the last time you sharpened your knives? Here's the interesting thing. The steel that you see everybody using, that doesn't sharpen your knife. That hones it. Sharpening is different. You are actually taking a little bit of the metal off the knife to get the edge perfectly straight and perfectly aligned. As you use a kitchen knife, that's going to get slightly out of alignment. If you look close, it's actually slightly bent on the blade. What a honing steel does is it takes that slight misalignment and gets it back in. And it's great, but it's not completely sharpening. Now, whether you want to sit down in 2019 and learn how to use an actual knife stone, a whetstone, a knife block, it takes some time, but it's worth it if you want to get your knives really sharp. Or do some looking around in your area, find out who's a good professional knife sharpener in your area. This I cannot stress enough. Get lots of good recommendations, because a lot of people say they sharpen knives. Not everybody does it well. You find a good person to sharpen your knives, your kitchen skills are going to get a lot better.
Safety warning, if you hone or sharpen a knife, alert everyone else who uses that knife. Because last time I had bloodshed, it was a knife that I thought was going to be dull. and was not. We are talking about New Year's cooking resolutions on this edition of Food Friday with Lori Skelton. We heard some of our colleagues. Larry Mueller wants to learn to use an Instapot. Karina Abrego-Koch in our Green Bay Bureau said the same thing. Those are their resolutions. You can join in with what you want to learn in the kitchen at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We offer recipes often, Lori, on Food Friday. This week, no exception. One resolution people can do, and maybe this is a good one for me, to up our sauce game.
Yep.
You've got a recipe for us for a basic sauce that we can build on.
It's one of those things that you see your parents do it or you see your friends do it all the time. Put a piece of protein in a saucepan and saute it, and then they take the protein out, let it rest, and then they throw a few things in the pan and they whip up a great sauce. And it's one of those things that it looks completely easy, but unless you've practiced it, unless you've gone through the steps, you can end up with a lumpy mess rather quickly. So we put up a recipe for a good basic pan sauce where, again, this is another place where it's helpful while your protein is sauteing. Measure everything else that you're going to need for that sauce out ahead of time, and then you've got a great method of leave a tablespoon of the fat in the pan, deglaze the pan with red wine or red wine vinegar or maybe some citrus juice and a little bit of cream, a little bit of cornstarch, and suddenly you've got a great simple sauce. And once you've mastered the basic technique, you can get really creative with additional herbs or additional seasonings. And it's completely simple, but it will really up your kitchen game.
Yeah, I've tried sauce before, but I've never really gotten the hang of trying to improve it. So, what are some of the secrets of doing that? Is it about adding spices, or is it just the sauce itself? Whether you're making meat or fish,
this is where practice really comes in handy, because you get creative when you've got the basics down. It's like muscle memory when you're playing the piano or swinging a golf club. You do it, and suddenly you don't have to think about what you're doing. You get a chance to think about other things. So let me ask you, what spices do you like in the kitchen?
See, I like lemon pepper.
Okay.
I like, you know, paprika.
Okay.
So things like that. Things that are flavorful and spicy.
Okay.
Lemon.
Those are great ways to get started with a basic pan sauce. Instead of using alcohol to deglaze your pan, use a little bit of stock and some of that citrus juice. Maybe what you might want to try is, do you grind your own pepper? Have you ever cracked pepper?
I have not.
Okay. Well, that right there is going to make quite a difference in how your sauce tastes. Okay. If you go out and get peppercorns, and you don't have to do anything fancy. A lot of professional chefs will just take a heavy saucepan and crack those peppercorns on the counter. Make certain it's not a butcher block counter that you're going to dent permanently, but
sure.
Crack the peppercorns under that heavy saucepan, and just the simple act of fresh cracked pepper might change your sauce up. Paprika, that would be a lovely addition for chicken. You don't want to use too much. That can get in the way fairly quickly. But just a little, I think, might really surprise you.
It's Food Friday, and we're making New Year's resolutions for the kitchen with WPR's Lori Skelton.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a cooking skill you want to get better at, maybe in 2019? Are you challenging yourself with a different style of cuisine or a different ingredient? Are you trying to eat healthier or reduce waste in the kitchen? Or if you've succeeded in something that used to intimidate you in cooking, let us know about that. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, you can find that basic sauce recipe at wpr.org/Food Friday.
We'll pick this conversation up in just a bit here on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Lori Skelton about New Year's resolutions for the kitchen.
And we're taking your calls and your kitchen resolutions, if any, at 800-642-1234. What do you want to get better at in the kitchen? And do you need some advice for Lori on how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Ed is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ed.
Well, Ms. Skelton was probably still is a longtime member of the Milwaukee Symphony Chorus.
Yep. I'm not singing Messiah this weekend, but, yeah, I'm still in the chorus.
I'd like to know one tip or recipe that you have received from another chorus member that you use in the kitchen, or the best tip you've ever gotten from a chorus member.
From another chorus member. Boy, there have been so many over the years. Is there something you're thinking about, Ed?
No, maybe even Andreas Delft in his time gave you a recipe from Germany.
I've never talked food with Andreas Delft, I'm sorry to say. What I know with the symphony chorus, it can get fascinating. We have a chance to trade what works for a singer. And everybody has their own thing that does or doesn't work. Some people love coffee before they sing. Some people can't handle caffeine before they sing. The one thing that I got from a voice teacher when I first started singing in Milwaukee was, she said the perfect singer's food before a concert was macaroni and cheese. It's the perfect combination of protein and carbohydrate. I told that to half the singers in the chorus, and they thought I was nuts. All that dairy before you sing, mm-hmm. they said, no, it just doesn't work. So one particular tip from a singer, I don't know that there is one. The lovely thing is I've been a member of this chorus since the mid-1980s, and we've had a chance to share a lot of good things over the years.
Ed, thanks a lot for the call. By the way, I forgot to mention again, you can find a sauce recipe, a starter sauce that you can build on at wpr.org/foodfriday.
How do you, Lori, select a good cut of meat? I always struggle with that when going to the grocery store. Like, how do you know what's a good cut of meat from a not-so-good one?
Are we talking chicken, pork, beef? What are
you? Well, chicken isn't bad in terms of, you can always find, you know, what's good and what isn't. But I think beef and steak is something I always have an issue with.
If I'm looking at a steak that's been packaged, I tend to shy away from something that looks a little gray.
Okay.
But I will be honest, in the last several years, I've gotten so comfortable with the farmers who are bringing meat to the farmers market in Madison, and I've gotten so comfortable talking to butchers in the Madison area. I very seldom buy prepackaged meat anymore. I talk to them about what's fresh today, what are you recommending, what looks good. Very often that means you're going to be changing your recipe. And that's what a lot of cooks recommend. Don't get so tied to a recipe that, well, it has to be such and such cut of meat. If your butcher is telling you, you know, I don't really have anything that I can recommend with that particular cut today, but I've got something over here that you might like just as well. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Go ahead and say, how would you prepare it? Or go ahead and ask, I tried this on the grill 2 weeks ago and it was a complete disaster. What did I do wrong? Finding a good cut of meat does take a little bit of work. Again, it comes down to that practicing the basics. And in this case, go ahead and make friends with the person who's actually doing the carving.
We're talking to Lori Skelton on this week's edition of Food Friday, getting some New Year's resolutions for the kitchen for 2019. Lori, you asked around for people for stuff they wanted to accomplish. And one thing you heard from some people is, and I'm there too, trying to reduce waste, throw away less stuff in the kitchen. Can you give us a couple tips that we can try?
One thing that I've gotten to do in the last 6 months, I moved. And so garbage day is now a different day of the week. Garbage day for me is now Thursday. I've set myself a challenge that if I'm home on Wednesday night and I'm cooking dinner, Wednesday night is the night that I go to the refrigerator and I haul everything out. I see what's about to go spare, what's about to get spoiled, but is still good. And I just sit down and kind of toss it all together and see what happens. It sounds a little odd. I'm not saying every combination of vegetables and protein that I've come up with is going to be on your local restaurant menu. I have made some mistakes, but for the most part, it has definitely reduced the amount of food that I throw out because, oh shoot, I forgot that I had salad greens in the back part of the crisper. Salad greens tossed in a pan with a little bit of olive oil and maybe some leftover roast potatoes. You throw that together, you get it warmed up, crack an egg or two on top of that, and you've got dinner. So set yourself one night a week where you just say, I'm going to clear out the refrigerator. And while you're doing that, make a list of the jar of the one exotic ingredient that you bought for one recipe and you haven't used it since. Go ahead and throw a little bit of that in there. Okay, so maybe you don't normally cook with Thai curry paste. Maybe you'll find out that throwing just a little bit of that one jar that you had in the back of the cupboard might just transform your cooking. So that's been my big takeaway from this year, in addition to the curries, is having one night where all I do is get rid of the leftovers. Obviously, I haven't killed myself yet, so.
let's take a call. Let's go to Emil. Emil from Rhinelander. Emil, welcome to Central Time. Hello.
Yes, sir. I am a Bohemian cook from way back. I got two grandmas back, all home recipes. I got a little tip that I give everyone, and they love it. When I make coffee cake, I make the butter crumbs out of the melted butter and the flour and the sugar and a little vanilla, and then I make sausages out of it, like it. I put it in the freezer, and then I just grate it over my coffee cake. I don't have to fool making butter crumbs each time.
What a good idea.
Wow, Emil, that sounds good.
Yeah, it works great, okay?
That now, obviously, that involves some planning, but there are a number of recipes where you can make a big batch of something, do what he did, freeze it, or, you know, find the right way to store it, do a little bit of Googling, do a little bit of research, see what will keep in your freezer or refrigerator, and then, yes, the next time you're cooking something, you've got it made. It does involve planning, and I know for a lot of people, it's the planning that can really trip them up. But if you can incorporate even just one or two things that you do ahead of time that you know you've got it, it's a great suggestion. Thank you for that.
I want to spend our last minute and a half, Lori, on a South American cooking. That's something you're going to be working on in the coming year, in part because you're probably going to be on this WPR trip to South America, Argentina and Chile, I think.
Coming
info,
up
by the way, at WPR.org/travel. What are you looking ahead at in cooking in 2019?
Well, something that has started to show up in Madison at some of the push carts are arepas, the corn cakes that you can stuff with wonderful, I guess for the most part, it's animal.
Anything, basically.
Animal protein shows up a lot, but you can do it with vegetables. You can
Beans.
Do it with beans and plantains. So those are the corn cakes that show up in various guises throughout South America. And, of course, empanadas. And anyone who's living in the Milwaukee area, I know if you go on the south side of Milwaukee to the El Rey grocery store, they have a lot of those doughs for wonderful filled things done ahead of time. So you can sort of cheat a little bit. You don't have to make the dough right offhand, but you can get used to making those flavorful fillings and then have somebody else make the dough.
Now, I love those arepas if you're looking for a product tester, Lori, keep in mind.
I will.
And
absolutely.
Thanks, as always, Lori. Good to talk to you again.
Good to be here.
Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host. She's with us every couple of months for Food Friday. Today we're talking about some New Year's resolutions in the kitchen. There's still time to share your resolution for 2019 in the kitchen over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and find the recipe Lori mentioned earlier at WPR.org/Food Friday for that sauce that'll get you started.